I was really interested in the restrictions on reports of a shared content of different attitudes. You know, John expects what Mary claims seems kind of funny. And since, but of course, sometimes this kind of thing is okay, as in your wish is my command, or the problem with their relationship is that he wants what she fears, and so on. And so I was wondering if there's anything to be said about those kinds of variations. Yeah,
so in general, I think this ontology of attitudinal objects has some flexibility to it. And one, in fact, can abstract more general attitudinal objects from particular verbs. And when you, in fact, you can say, John finally claimed what Mary only expected, or so. So you focus, and what is going on in those cases, and actually that's what I described already in my 2003 paper, is you do a sort of reanalysis of the verb into a modifier and a more general attitudinal kind of verb. So like acceptance, plus assertively presenting and so, yeah. I mean, the fact that you need to emphasize indicates that there's something special going on, and yeah. And sometimes attitudinal objects are coordinated, like you wish is my command, the one attitudinal object is sort of a satisfier of the other one, and yeah. But these are special cases, which of course one has to deal with, but they also need to be recognized as special rather than as a general case.
So this is something I don't want you to answer now, but I just want it there in case there's time at the end. So this has obvious application to the specificity problem for desires, because you've got this thing which is, you know, my heart's desire, which is, you predicate the sentence that's used in the complement of, you know, what I want in some sense. And of course, there might be details left out, so I want some milk, but I don't want sour milk, et cetera. Here's the question for later, not now. Mm-hmm. Why is there a specificity problem for desire, but not for, say, belief, given that the same resources would seem to be available on your storage? Yeah. Anyway, that's not a question. It's a, you'll have to make it a new verb for it's a postponed question.
Yeah. I think it does have to do with the direction of fit, and I do agree that it's actually limited to desire. That's why, I changed the account of sentence meanings from an earlier one on which sentences just give the partial content of an attitudinal object. So I take that to be a special case, and yeah.
Thank you for your talk. I'm Paul again, yes, sorry. I had a question about the interesting example you raised of John partly regrets that S. So I was thinking, could it mean that John regrets part of the content, that is, and I was imagining that it might be difficult. So suppose that John regrets that Peter left the department. For instance, what he regrets is that he no longer can go to the cafe with Peter, but he does not regret Peter's sudden angers, you see what I mean? Sudden states of being angry. So if I look at the proposition that John left, that would include all and only a state of affairs in which they don't go to the cafe, and Peter does not go into these states of anger. So if you restrict, you know, within that proposition, It seems that what is being regretted is rather the complement to that proposition, and some content to the complement to that proposition.
Yeah.
And I wonder, if that fits with the other thing you said about the fact that you don't see the attitude verbs as describing a direct relation between the verb and the proposition expressed by the complement, but something more. Yeah, thank you. That's the question.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So on my current view, so regret would describe a relation between agents and facts, and then the fact is characterized by the complement clause, or the fact has this content given by John Left. So that's interesting. Yeah, I'll think about it. Yeah,
okay,
thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was wondering also about the partly regret example. I have two things, I'll just start with that. I was thinking it formed part of a sort of nice argument about how the factivity of regret works, and I just wanted to see if I got this right. I mean, if you think that regret, that P, includes a kind of nominal operator that turns P into a fact, in a way, like, so you have something like the fact that P, and then you sort of varied about, some linguists think it's this way and that way, but the point is the factivity is entirely caused by that. And then the part, so the selection property of regret, that it needs something factive, causes the factivity, which has the nice result that when you put a partly in front of it, partly doesn't make any partiality to the factivity. So like when you say, I partly regret that, P has to be, the implication that P holds, not part of P holds, but it's just the regret is partial, which seems like a nice sort of structure of an argument that there really is a nominalization that doesn't come from the verb, except, or, comes from the verb only, and the verb demands a nominal complement that's factive. I mean, is that the kind of line you'd endorse there as a kind of argument for your construction of that sentence?
Exactly, yeah. And so as opposed to, for example, so John partly agreed that S, where you do not have factivity, but you measure a given like claim or something.
And the other thing was about the partial, I mean, so I take it as both like a kind of advantage and potential disadvantage. If you want to embrace the idea that partiality, as you use partial to kind of, or similar words to modify attitude verbs, kind of goes the truth maker way. I mean, so having the truth makers gives you a way of understanding what partial means. But I guess the one thing I would say is, in relation to Paul's talk, for instance, it seems like there's these other interpretations of partial, like, I partially believe he's a Republican, because there's like one interpretation of Republican, how he votes in the election, in which he is, another interpretation, like which party he's officially registered with and which he's not. And that is, as Paul, I think, argued, I think quite well, just can't be understood in the truth maker way, in a natural way. So I wonder, it's kind of like, it's a partial analysis of partial, maybe.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Actually, belief is also quite interesting because it does allow for partially to somehow relate to the content, as opposed to think, which doesn't. So I partially think that John is a Republican. It doesn't make any sense. And so actually for me, belief involves a content bearer as an argument. And so it is distinct from think, which doesn't. Thanks. So that was good.
Yes. Please. Gideon.
Hi, Veronica. Gideon Rosa. This is a naive question. So you have in the relevant ontology propositions of a sort that your opponents regard as the objects of attitudes. So it's not as if you deny the existence of things like the proposition that Snow is white, right? Is that correct?
Why do I have those?
Well, I was thinking, John believes that snow is white.
Uh-huh.
So we can ask, we can speak of what John believes.
Mm-hmm.
And we can say things like, what John believes could have been true even if there were no believers.
Mm-hmm.
So what John believes isn't a belief, where that's understood as a concrete mental particular or something like that. Because what John believes is the kind of thing that could have been true and so could have existed even if there had been no human beings. So I was thinking that what John believes understood in that way has to be something that's abstract in a way that a proposition is.
Well, it could be true in a world in which there are no beliefs, but that doesn't imply that.
What is this?
So what John believes.
In the world where there are no believers.
Yeah. Hmm?
There's this thing that's true.
The thing is true in those worlds, but that doesn't mean it needs to be in those.
Ah, okay. I mean, that's a way you could go. I was thinking that just as something can't be read in a world where it doesn't exist, something can't be true in a world where it doesn't exist. That's a theoretical issue. It's not intuitions. That shouldn't count for anything. But that's what I. The reason I was imputing to you the view that there are these proposition-like objects is that I was imagining that you would concede that.
I mean, I do.
A thing that's true.
I do make use of definitely of kinds of attitudinal objects, and those would permit a view on which they can exist without an instance. So that's something I definitely need. So the belief that S is true or so. But it is sort of important that truth bearers are mind dependent. So this account also, this approach is supposed to account for the ability to be true or false, leaving it to the philosophy of mind to explain that, and rather than for semantics is to explain how a proposition can be true or false or represent anything. So making use of mind-dependent objects so means I can leave it up to the philosopher of mind to explain why something can be true or false or represent. I don't have to deal with the problem of the truth directedness and the unity of the proposition as a philosopher of language or semanticist. And that is meant to be one major advantage.
Good, so that puts you in roughly the same camp as Soames and Hanks on that sort of issue. The thing that's true, even if there are no human beings, isn't a truly abstract proposition, it's a mental state type. For you or
That I share. Taking truth and representation to pertain to mind-dependent objects.
I really enjoyed it. I was thinking how, for you, the semantics of the situation aligns very, very closely with the metaphysics of the situation. I take this to be part of a kind of a... Emon Bach had this paper about natural language metaphysics where he is asking what do speakers speak as if there is? As opposed to what there is. What do speakers speak as if there is? And so there's a kind of a natural language metaphysics that we can try to isolate, and I take this to be part of a larger project, but then it strikes me that there's certain burdens on your account that have to do with the metaphysics. And I'm just wondering how, I'm sure you have answers to those, but I was just wondering about some of these details. So just in keeping with what Gideon was just asking, some attitudinal objects we want to say are also modal objects. So, something that I believe is contingent or something like that. And so it's, it looks like, from the, this type of data, that it's one and the same object that is believed, but also the bearer of moral properties. So is it in your case that cases like this get somehow handled in the metaphysics of the situation? Is it something about the verbs that does this, that selects? So that's that one mm-hmm. type of question. Then there are questions about troublemaker cases, and I'm sure you have views about this, you know, empty cases where, you know, I can really believe Homer was a wonderful poet, turns out there is no Homer, but, you know, what is the attitudinal object in such a case, and what exactly is it consistent as a matter of its own nature, so to speak?
Mm-hmm.
Then there are cases of things that look like the verb itself behaves in a way that cuts across some of these categories. So, you know, I can fear that such and such, but also I can be phobic. So cases of phobia, where mm-hmm. I just don't like spiders. You know, I think that's a David Beckham mm-hmm. example. I don't like elevators or something like that. So all these, so, you know, so if you're, so for people whose mm-hmm. semantics is much more loosely constrained
mm-hmm.
and is constraining of the metaphysics, you know, these are questions that we have a certain kind of latitude in how to handle those issues. But for you, it seems to me that the semantics had better be, we had better be able to take it with metaphysical seriousness. Like, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. There's a kind of a burden on this. And I'm just wondering, in some of these cases, what you'd like to say. First of all, did I mischaracterize you in saying that this is kind of part of this general project of where the semantics and the metaphysics align very closely with one another?
Yeah, so definitely. So in fact, I would this project goes along with my own commitment to natural language ontology, as I call it. And in fact, for the so this the theory of meaning, so I make use of entities in that ontology, these attitudinal objects. So natural language uncovers for me these entities that, for I would say, provide novel solutions to philosophical problems like those that arise for abstract propositions and so. So recognizing those objects that natural language tells us about is very important. Yeah, so that, So for some of your issues, I have particular views that develop from within this approach. Like, I actually would say certain attitudinal objects can have a sort of modal part, a part that's a modal object. That was something I made use of when I gave a semantics of so-called harmonic modals. So John demanded that Bill must leave, or so. So must is somehow licensed by the kind of force of demand. Now, if demand is an illocutionary object, how would that work? So must takes modal objects, and so needs or something. And I take the modal object to be a part of the demand. In fact, there is an act of requesting or demanding that produces two things, a illocutionary product, a demand, and a modal product, a need. And that's actually also very intuitive. So we produce modal products all the time, passing laws and so on. This is definitely something. And in fact, that's also an option that I would have if there's independent motivations, let's say, for saying that when I say what John believes, what in fact stands for modal objects or a state of affairs that is associated with John's belief, that would still be within this framework, yeah. One just needs to motivate that independently. So one can't just make use of these various entities arbitrarily, but one would have to say that what can systematically pick out a state of affairs or under particular conditions or so. So I have a fairly flexible, rich ontology, but it's meant to be systematic and motivated by linguistics, including syntactic facts. And then, so the case of what was it, Homer? Yeah. Here I just share an issue with truth-maker semantics in general, so sentence-based truth-maker semantics. How do you deal with non-existent objects? So I don't have anything special to say within my framework. Maybe outside of it, I have a particular view, but here I have nothing special to say. That's an issue that we all deal with, yeah. And then finally, attitudes that are directed toward objects rather than sort of propositional contents, they are actually quite interesting. So maybe not fear so-and-so, but like search for a house or... they are really interesting for me because I think they involve objects, which I would call intentional objects, that have as satisfiers objects, though in situations, like a house with certain qualities, that's a satisfier of my search. Or if I owe Bill a coin, so a particular coin is a satisfier of my debt. So this would go along with this view that the satisfiers of objects include a greater range than the situations and actions and illocutionary objects. Also just objects with particular qualities can act as satisfiers. And I sort of have a sketch of extending this account to intentional transitive verbs in my theoretical linguistics article that is mentioned here.
Thank you.
Perhaps the last question. Perhaps I would like to come back to the mind dependence or mind independence of the content. In the case of factive of activity or factive verbs, the meaning of factivity is that the complement of the that clause is mind independent. Otherwise, you have not real or echt factivity, but quasi-factivity, like regret. How do you... This is an objection to your... Isn't it an objection to your whole supposition that the content is always mind-dependent?
No. So it's my category of modal objects consists in things that are not mind-dependent, even though they may have been produced by like an illocutionary act or so, like laws are modal objects. They can be that, and some of them have the status of abstract artifacts. So they are produced, they're in some sense mind dependent. But in general, so modal objects are not as such mind dependent. Yeah, and they so my approach is here. So the descriptive metaphysics approach. So I note that we make reference to these modal objects. They come with satisfaction predicates. They come with a content. It can be a partial content of something. I don't assume that they generally are mind dependent. And some of them are just construed from the truth makers of a sentence. From what they are construed may be mind dependent, but then they just are things that have satisfiers that are situations of a sort and violators that are situations of a sort, and that's it, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, it was the last question. Thank you very much.